First, for anyone who's not familiar, I just want to briefly talk about the beginning of quantum logic. So this was originated by Birkhoff and von Neumann. Basically what they did is they examined the measurement propositions associated with the physical system. So these are statements of the form, if I measure an observable quantity A, I obtain an outcome in the range delta, where delta is typically taken to be some Borel subset of the reals. And this is the case for classical or quantum physical systems. In the classical case, what we find is that the measurement propositions correspond in a one-to-one fashion exactly with the subsets of the phase space. So for example, if we have a state space for a pendulum, so you got like the angle and the angular momentum, then any proposition will correspond just to some subset of the phase space. In the quantum case, on the other hand, what we find is that the measurement propositions correspond to closed linear subspaces of the Hilbert space rather than Borel subsets of the phase space. Or equivalently, you can think of this as corresponding to projection operators, since every closed linear subspace corresponds uniquely to a projection operator on the Hilbert space. And these projection operators form what's called an orthomodular lattice. This is an algebraic structure that's a lot like a Boolean algebra, but just with some small differences. And I'll go into some more details on this later. But basically, the idea here today is that we're going to, just as one can build a mathematics based on Boolean reasoning, you can also build a mathematics based on a non-Boolean or more quantum reasoning. So, of course, a natural question is, how can this mathematics apply to physics? Now, as everyone knows, I mean, quantum physics is radically different than the classical theory. Here's just a couple quotes to illustrate the point. And so the hope is, in developing quantum mathematics, we'll have a natural framework to re-express or reformulate quantum theory. The hope would be that we could develop quantum theory in its own native language, so to speak. And hopefully this would shed some light on foundational and interpretational issues. Before I go any farther, I do want to point out there's two ways you can think about the connection between quantum logic and mathematics. One is sort of a very strong connection where you take quantum logic to be the right logic. Basically, the idea here is that classical logic was developed empirically, like through our interaction with the physical world, interacting with a classical world, basically. And as such, now that we know that the world doesn't behave classically at the foundational level, we should replace our way of reasoning about the world. And this is maybe a view best explicated by Hilary Putnam. What I want to point out is that we don't really need to assume anything this strong for this project to bear fruit. All we need is that quantum logic might be a useful logic for formulating mathematics that would help give us some insights into quantum mechanics. So this is all I want to assume for today. Also, I want to briefly mention some previous developments in quantum mathematics. There's actually not really been too much that's been published. There's been a few little developments by a number of researchers, but these are probably the two most significant. The first is a work by J. Michael Dunn. What he did is he examined the axioms of piano arithmetic in quantum logic. And what he found is that these axioms yield exactly the same theorems under classical or quantum logic. So essentially, you get the same mathematics no matter which logic you use. This, in a way, illustrates just how close quantum logic is to classical logic. This is an intriguing result. If it was generic and held for all mathematics, this would completely undermine the program we're trying to do here. We want to develop new mathematics that might be useful for formulating quantum theory. The other significant development in quantum mathematics was by Takeuchi. He developed a rich and powerful quantum set theory. And while the set theory has a lot of structure to it, it's also very difficult to work with, so much so, in fact, that it prompted him to say this. A development of mathematics with quantum logic is not impossible. However, I now feel it is not very worthwhile because of its extreme difficulty. So I guess one of the advantages of being at the early stages of one's career is that one doesn't have to be the good sense to be intimidated by hard problems. Today, first, I'm going to, as promised, go into some more detail about the Birkhoff von Neumann take on quantum logic. And then, using this as motivation, we'll build a general framework for doing quantum mathematics. After we have this general framework in place, we'll develop two branches of quantum mathematics, at least the beginnings of them. There's other areas that we've worked on that I could talk about, but I chose these two basically for the reason that quantum set theory would hopefully form a foundation for all of quantum mathematics, much as classical set theory does for all of classical mathematics. And so this might be, at least in a foundational sense, the most important branch of quantum mathematics to investigate. And then the arithmetic, I'll investigate it because it grows naturally out of the quantum set theory, and also because, as we'll see, it has a natural connection to quantum mechanical observables. And then I'll finish with a few concluding remarks. So first, the logic of physical systems. So as I mentioned earlier, the classical logic of a classical system is embodied in the algebra of subsets of the phase space. And so just to give you some examples, if we have a particle in a box, just a one-dimensional particle in a box, so the x here goes from minus 5 to plus 5, and the p can be infinite, so any momentum whatsoever, you can form an example measurement proposition. For example, the momentum must be between minus 3 and plus 3. That would correspond to this red shaded region of the phase space. Similarly, for any proposition, you can form its negation. So in this case, this would correspond to the set theoretic complement, just the white region. We could also consider other propositions, such as the magnitude of the position is less than 3. This would correspond to this blue region in phase space. And given multiple propositions, we can consider their conjunction and disjunction. So the conjunction is just given by the set theoretic intersection, and the disjunction by the set theoretic union. And then there are also a couple of trivial propositions. So there's one proposition that's always true. This just corresponds to the entire phase space. And there's one proposition that's always false, which corresponds to the empty set. And so this algebra of subsets forms a Boolean algebra. Now, in the quantum case, I'll illustrate this with a relatively simple system, just the internal degrees of freedom of a spin one particle spanned by a three-dimensional Hilbert space, which is sort of illustrated here, at least the real vector space version of it, to the right. And similarly, we can consider measurement propositions. I have here a simple quantum mechanical observable, which corresponds to this Hermitian operator that's listed here. It has three outcomes, minus 1, 0, plus 1. And so you might form a measurement proposition, such if I measure A, the outcome will be less than or equal to 0. This will correspond to this projection operator here, or the xy subspace, the xy plane. Similarly to the classical case, we can form the negation. In this case, we start to see some non-classical behavior. So the negation of this proposition is that the outcome of A is greater than 0. And this corresponds not to the set theoretic complement of the xy plane, but rather the orthogonal complement, so just the z-axis, or just this one-dimensional projector here. We can also look at other propositions, such that the outcome is greater than or equal to 0. This would correspond to the yz plane. And we can look at conjunctions and disjunctions. So the and corresponds to the intersection, set theoretic intersection, just as in the classical case. And so for these two propositions, greater than or equal to 0 and less than or equal to 0 just means equal to 0. So that just corresponds to the state phi 0 right here. The disjunction behaves non-classically again. Of course, a little thought reveals that it had to. Of course, the union is not a closed linear subspace, and so we really need the smallest subspace containing it. In this case, that's just given by the closed linear span of these two subsets, which in this case is just all of the Hilbert space. We have a couple of trivial propositions. So the always true proposition is given by the whole Hilbert space, or equivalently the identity operator, and the trivially false proposition is given by just the subspace consisting of only the zero vector, or equivalently the zero operator. And so these the set of all projection operators then forms what's called an orthomodular lattice. And this is called the projection lattice of the Hilbert space. And so we can consider Boolean algebras and orthomodular lattices abstractly. First, I'll just standardize a little notation and use a wedge for and, v for or, the symbol for negation, one for the true proposition, zero for the false. And then we can characterize Boolean algebras and orthomodular lattices as abstract algebras, so just sets along with a number of operations, two binary, one unary, and two constant operations. And we can characterize these completely algebraically, so I'm not going to list all of the identities. They're not all that illuminative. Here's some examples. But I do want to point out the basic difference. So all of the axioms are the same, except for these two. In Boolean algebras, we have distributivity, which is given by this identity here. But in orthomodular lattices, we only have the weaker orthomodular law, which is given here. It's not obvious that it's weaker, but it's pretty easy to show using the other identities. Now, one thing I want to point out is that while Boolean algebras are, very closely connected to classical physics, it's not clear if orthomodular lattices are exactly the right algebraic structure to be using in quantum logic. In particular, there are a lot of orthomodular lattices that are not projection lattices. The reason why we're going to work with orthomodular lattices is because they're basically the most general algebraic structure that will allow us to develop the quantum mathematics, and we just don't want to leave anything out. So we'll just work as generally as we can. And one more thing I want to say is that for Boolean algebras, at least, there's a quintessential algebra that basically characterizes the class of all Boolean algebras. And this is just the Boolean algebra containing only the two elements 0 and 1, or true and false. While for orthomodular lattices, there's no such algebra that characterizes the whole variety of orthomodular lattices.
So a question. So in terms of generality, so in sort of quantum measurement theory, there's also not just projection valued measures, but also positive operator valued measures.
Right.
And then each outcome is associated with a positive operator, which may not be a projection operator.
Mm-hmm.
So what is this? Do these kinds of positive operators have any status? What do you have this framework?
It's a more general framework. Essentially, we're trying to deal with only ideal measurements, since we're dealing with logic, so we want to sort of stay as deterministic as possible. The structure that those form, an effect algebra, doesn't really have the order is not a lattice order, and so we can't do all of the manipulations we need to do quantum mathematics. So, all right. So now that we have these basic algebraic ideas in mind, we can go on and start to use these to develop some quantum mathematics. So first, I need to talk about syntax. Of course, if we're going to do mathematics, we need to say precisely what we mean by what a mathematical statement is. This is encoded in the syntax, and this will be the same for quantum and classical logic. And so you have a bunch of allowed symbols and allowed ways of combining them. Of course, the allowed symbols depend upon which branch of mathematics you're considering. Today, we'll consider two branches, set theory and arithmetic. So in set theory, we only have one special symbol, the set theoretic membership symbol, which is a predicate symbol. For arithmetic, we only have one predicate symbol, namely equality, but we also have a number of function symbols. So we have a symbol for addition and multiplication. They've got the dots over them to distinguish them for like the linear algebraic sum, since they'll occur together later. Also, we have this prime, which denotes a successor. So this is just given a number, take the next number, and a symbol for the zero of the number, so the additive identity. Also, we need other symbols, of course, to make mathematical statements. So we need variables. We also need logical connectives, symbols standing for and, or, not, as well as some existential and universal quantifiers, the for all and there exists up there, as well as parentheses to parse everything. And then there's a long list of precise rules for determining when a given string of symbols is, in fact, a formal statement. I'll just rely on intuition here and show a few examples. So just some random string of symbols, of course, is not going to be a formal statement, but these would be a couple of examples of formal statements. So for set theory, we might have something like there exists a set y such that for every x, x is in y and x is not in y. Of course, that's false in set theory. And in arithmetic, we'd have an allowed statement such as for all x, x times 0 equals 0. That would be true. But in order to talk about truth and falsity, we really need to go beyond syntax. We need to go into semantics. And while we'll focus on semantics today, I want to point out that there's really two approaches to mathematical logic. There's also the way of dealing with it in terms of formal deductions. In this way of doing things, you write down a set of axioms, and then you have a bunch of rules for determining what formal statements follow from those axioms. We could equivalently develop quantum logic in terms of formal deductions. More precisely, we have theorems of soundness and completeness for quantum logic, an analogy to classical logic, but I'm just not going to have time to go into all that today, so we'll just focus on semantics. And by semantics, I mean creating models or mathematical structures and truth valuation. And so I'll be a little bit more explicit about that here. So first, I want to go over classical semantics. And so for classical semantics, we start with a special set A of axioms, just a set of formal statements. And we also have a number of moving parts to construct a model for these axioms. So first, we need a universe of objects, which will serve for something for the variables to run over. as well as an interpretation of our function symbols as actual operations on this universe of objects. And then, finally, we'll need a truth valuation, and this will tell us when a given formal statement is true or false. Of course, there's going to be some restrictions on this truth valuation. The axioms, we want them to be true, so we'll require that the axioms evaluate to one. Also, we want to actually enforce the interpretation of our logical symbols as we would intuitively think of them, so that if we have, for example, the statement B is true, well, not B better be false. And similarly for the and, or, et cetera. Just to go over a quick example of this, we can look at the usual model of arithmetic. So the universe just consists of the usual natural numbers, 0, 1, 2, et cetera. The interpretation is just the natural one. So the symbol 0 is interpreted as the number 0. The successor is interpreted as just adding 1 to a number. Multiplication and addition are given their usual interpretation. And then we have the truth valuation, which is given by the usual procedure of just running over the universe and seeing if the statement is satisfied, given the usual evaluations. And so for example, for all y, y times 1 equals y, well, we just evaluate y times 1 according to this interpretation. It gives us y. We see that y indeed does equal y. And so since that's true for every y, this is 1. Similarly, evaluating there exists an x such that x equals x prime is easily seen to be false. One crucial fact that we'll need to know is that you can equivalently formulate semantics for classical logic, not with 0, 1 being the usual, being the truth values, so like we have here, but rather with any complete Boolean algebra. The completeness is just sort of a technical requirement that I'm not going to go into. But more or less, any complete Boolean algebra serving as the truth values will yield exactly the same classical mathematics. Just to give a vague idea of what I mean about this without going into details, I just mean that for a given set of axioms, you'll be able to prove exactly the same theorems, no matter which semantics you use, either 0, 1, or the semantics where you have any Boolean algebra here. As we saw earlier, to go from classical logic to quantum logic of a physical system, we just replace Boolean algebras with orthomodular lattices, and so that's how we'll build our quantum mathematics. So a quantum model for a set of axioms will be similar to a classical model. We'll just let the truth values take their values in an orthomodular lattice. So the universe will be similar to the classical universe. We'll also have interpretation of function symbols. And the truth valuation will still satisfy the same criteria as before. So the axioms will still have to evaluate to the top element, the one of the orthomodular lattice, and we'll still have to respect the interpretation of the logical connectives. To give an example of a possible quantum model of arithmetic, we could use the same universe of numbers and the same interpretation of the function symbols and only change the truth values. And so depending on which axioms we chose and how we built the model, maybe some statements evaluate the same as they did in the classical case. So some statements like for all y times 1 equals y might still be true, but others might evaluate to a different truth value. So in this example, there exists an x such that x equals x prime might evaluate to some intermediate truth value that's neither true or false. Now, one thing I want to point out before I go on is that you might have two different sets of axioms which are classically equivalent, so that they yield exactly the same models or exactly the same classical mathematics, but this might no longer be the case in quantum mathematics. And so when we're trying to do something like set theory or arithmetic, there may be a number of equivalent different ways of formulating it classically, and so we might have to pick one of these quantum mechanically. And so it'll take some work to sort of pick out a most natural quantum model. So this will be important for us later on. And so this is the general framework for quantum mathematics. And using this now, we can start developing some quantum set theory. Now, we're going to develop axiomatic set theory. So just for anyone who's not familiar with it, I want to point out a few differences from the naive set theory that usually gets used. Probably the most striking difference is that in most developments of axiomatic set theory, every object is under consideration is actually a set. This may seem less general than the usual naive take on set theory, where you have some objects that aren't sets and some that are. But in fact, they can be shown to be equivalent. Basically, the idea is that if you construct some branch of mathematics within axiomatic set theory, you just forget about the internal set theoretic structure. So for example, number theory, you can realize every single number is a set, but then when doing number theory, you just don't ever reference the internal elements of any of these sets. And so they're really equivalent. But this just gives a more elegant way to handle set theory. Now, in the original attempts to axiomatically found set theory, there were only two axioms. These are the axiom of extensionality, which basically just says that sets are determined by their members, and also the so-called axiom of abstraction, which says that for any formal statement in the language of set theory, psi of x, so that it might depend on some variable x, you can form the set which will denote this, the set of all x such that psi of x is true. Of course, Bertrand Russell found that this is not a logically consistent set of axioms. And to do this, he basically just said, using the axiom of abstraction, we know that there exists a set S, which is the set of all X, such that X is not an element of itself. And then he just asked the question, well, is S an element of S? If it is, well, then by the definition of S, S can't be an element of itself. And so you run into a contradiction. On the other hand, if S is not an element of S, well, then again, by the definition of S, S has to be an element of itself. Either way, you run into a contradiction. And so these are not going to form a basis for an axiomatic set theory. It took mathematicians a little bit of time to develop a slightly more complicated set of axioms, the so-called Zermelo-Frankel axioms with choice. You don't need to know all the details of all these. Basically, the first one is just that extensionality I mentioned before, and the rest give various ways of building new sets from old sets. And we just need so many of them so that we have a rich enough set theory to actually found all of mathematics. And so these are the axioms we're going to construct a model of, a quantum model. Now, the standard model of set theory is the so-called classical universe. And this consists basically of every possible set you can construct from the empty set. So you just start with the empty set using transfinite recursion and all the axioms of set theory, you basically just build everything you can. And this gives us what's called the standard universe. So I should point out one subtlety here, and that's that mathematicians are not even sure if ZFC is really consistent or if the standard universe actually exists. In fact, you can't prove that this is the case by Gödel's incompleteness theorem, at least within ZFC itself. But this is really a question of pure mathematics, so we'll just assume that these things actually exist and forge ahead. And I want to point out that there's a different way of thinking about this classical universe. So basically, the idea is that with every set, we can just go through the usual procedure of identifying a set with its characteristic function. And so basically, every set A in the classical universe corresponds to some function from the classical universe to 0, 1. And this function is just given by f of x is equal to 1 if x is in A and 0 otherwise. Of course, not every map from the classical universe to 0, 1 corresponds to a set. For example, if you took the map which sent every set to 1, well, that would correspond to the set of all sets, which is not something that's allowed within ZFC. And so you do have to put this extra criteria on. So those sets correspond to those characteristic functions such that the preimage of 1 is a set, essentially. And given this, there's a straightforward way of generalizing this to the quantum case. Just as we replaced 0, 1 with an orthomodular lattice before, we can do the same thing here. And so for any orthomodular lattice L, we can build what's called the quantum universe, which is just the natural generalization. So F will be in the quantum universe for a given orthomodular lattice L if it's a map from the classical universe to L, and the set of all x such that f of x is not equal to 0 is a classical set. So this is a universe. We don't really need to worry about interpretation of function symbols in set theory since there are no function symbols. But we do need to provide a truth value to construct the model. First, we'll need a definition. So for any set in the quantum universe, QL, the support of f, which we'll denote this, is just the classical set where f is non-zero. So formula right there. And using this notion of a support, we can then define a truth valuation. So the truth valuation is given by this. First, I want to point out that we only have to define it on these elementary propositions. Anything more complicated involving ands, ors, there exists, for alls, et cetera, we can basically build by enforcing the fact that the rules on truth values, essentially that the truth valuation has to be more or less a homomorphism on these things. And this, yeah.
So can you just go back one slide?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the quantum universe needs the classical universe.
Right, yeah.
For its definition.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, so. So in developing these truth values, you know, basically we need an element of an orthomodular lattice for the truth value. So, well, G is a quantum set, so it's a map from the classical universe to L, an orthomodular lattice, and support F is a classical set, so this is a natural candidate. As it turns out, it's fairly easy to check that when our lattice L is just the usual 0-1 Boolean algebra, this actually reproduces the usual notion of a truth value for the classical universe. And so this will be our truth valuation for quantum set theory. Of course, we have to check that it satisfies the axioms of set theory, so that we actually have a model of set theory. And interestingly, what we find is that it does satisfy a set of axioms classically equivalent to Z of C, but not for a generic orthomodular lattice L. We actually need this orthomodular lattice to be a projection lattice of a Hilbert space. And so from this, you know, we can sort of see that there are probably some important logical properties hiding in the projection lattices that are not shared by all orthomodular lattices. And this sort of pops up naturally when attempting to construct quantum mathematics. Now, I'm not going to go into any of the details of proving any of that. That's take us a little bit too long. Yeah?
Sorry, in that last statement, did you mean that only projection lattices satisfy that equivalence, or could there be a larger class of orthomodular lattices?
So it's actually, we don't have an exact characterization. There are definitely other ones that do. First of all, there's certain sublattices of Hilbert lattices which do. Also, projection lattices of basically any von Neumann algebra will also satisfy it. But these are the only ones that we know of that satisfy it. So, but we don't have a characterization theorem to that effect. Right, so just to summarize what we've done in set theory so far is that we have a straightforward generalization of the classical universe. It reproduces the usual classical universe for L being the usual Boolean truth values. And it also satisfies some axioms classically equivalent to the ZFC axioms. Moreover, the set theory is a lot more mathematically tractable than previous attempts, such as Takeuchi's. Basically, Takeuchi, just to give you a brief idea, first, in the syntax, he has to introduce an infinite number of extra predicates before you even get to doing semantics. And then in doing the semantics, he has to define his model and truth evaluation both by transfinite recursions. And so it ends up just being a total mess to work with. I mean, he's a brilliant mathematician, and he's actually been able to do quite a bit, even given the difficulty. But there's nothing like a simple formula like this for the truth evaluation. Of course, we want to use this quantum set theory to actually build some mathematics. And as we'll see, this set theory is easily strong enough to construct a quantum version of the natural numbers. Now, a priori, you know, there's many things that could happen in trying to generalize the construction of the natural numbers from classical set theory. You know, we could, how a done, just basically reproduce exactly the classical natural numbers, in which case, you know, it's kind of a boring result, but that could happen. Or we could also get some sort of completely crazy and unwieldy set of natural numbers. As we'll see shortly, this is not what happens. We actually get a set of quantum natural numbers that has a very natural connection to quantum mechanical observables. So, quantum arithmetic. I want to talk about how arithmetic is built within the usual set theory, so we can see what we're generalizing. Basically, the idea is to start with the empty set, use that to represent the number 0, and then essentially we count using this successor operation. So basically, to every set, we form the set consisting of that set, union with the set containing that set, which is a little bit of a mouthful, but it's easy to see how it works out with some examples. So the first few natural numbers, 0 is of course the empty set. To get 1, we just add that set containing the empty set to nothing, essentially, to get this, which is just the set containing 0. And as we move on, we see that every number ends up being just the set of all numbers which are smaller than. And so this is how, heuristically, you construct these numbers. Of course, to do this formally, we actually need to construct some formal statements within classical mathematics. I'm not going to actually write them out as formal statements. I'll instead just write them out in words. But basically, we need this notion of an inductive set. So you define a set in the classical universe to be inductive if it contains the empty set, and also whenever some set is in that set, then also its successor is in that set. And then you can characterize the set of all natural numbers within classical set theory as just those sets which are contained in every inductive set. There's another property that the numbers have in classical set theory, and this is that they're also all transitive sets. And this transitivity essentially just means that the membership relation is transitive relative to these sets. So if you have C and B and A, then C is also an A. And you can characterize numbers in terms of transitive sets. I'm not going to go into that. I just want to point out that numbers in classical set theory are all naturally transitive. And so in generalizing the construction of the numbers to quantum set theory, this will be important. So first, I want to say that from now on, we're only going to consider those quantum universes, QL, such that L is a projection lattice, because we want to actually ensure that we really are working in set theory, at least something that satisfies the axioms of set theory, not something crazier. And then for these quantum sets, if we try and use this direct analog of a classical successor, it doesn't really appear to behave very naturally. Namely, if you just write out this definition, what happens is that it no longer takes transitive sets to transitive sets generically. And so it no longer even takes numbers to numbers. However, you know, there's an equivalent way of writing the classical successor on numbers. So in the classical case, this just reduces to the usual successor on numbers. But in the quantum case, it now preserves the transitivity of numbers. I'm not going to write out the formula. It's not too bad, but it's also not very illuminating. But so we can define this quantum successor. And then using this, we can attempt to define the quantum natural numbers in the same way. So basically, we take these quantum natural numbers, which I'll denote omega sub L, for some projection lattice L. So we'll get a different collection of quantum natural numbers depending on the projection lattice we use. These will be those quantum sets which are contained in every inductive set, but which are also transitive. Now, transitivity follows from being contained in every inductive set in classical logic, but not in quantum logic. So just to try and be as conservative as possible, we'll enforce both of these conditions. And then we have a nice characterization of these quantum natural numbers. Basically, these are quantum sets which are maps from the natural numbers to L. Of course, if you'll remember, a quantum set is a map from the classical universe to L. What I mean by this is just that F takes the value 0 on any set which is not a natural number. And it also has to satisfy these two extra properties. So first of all, this is a projection lattice. So F of every classical natural number is a projection operator. And so these have to be ordered in the usual operator ordering. Moreover, F has to be eventually 0 so that it doesn't take on non-zero values on all of the numbers. And so this is a nice characterization. But the interesting thing is that we can show that the quantum natural numbers characterized in such a way are exactly in one-to-one correspondence with all of the Hermitian operators with whole number eigenvalues. And so there's really an equivalence between these quantum natural numbers and observables with whole number eigenvalues. And so, I mean, this is kind of remarkable to me. I mean, this is when I really sort of thought that we're really onto something with this quantum mathematics. You know, we started just to try and generalize the classical universe, build a quantum version of set theory, and from that, then generalize the usual construction of the natural numbers. And out of this, we find nothing else but quantum mechanical observables. The correspondence is pretty easy to see. So first, I'll set a little notation. So for a quantum natural number A, I'm just going to define A sub n to be A acting on n minus 1 for every n greater than 1, and A sub 0 equal the identity. There's nothing to this. It really will just make the formulas a little bit cleaner. But using this notation, we can define the observable A hat to just be the sum over I equals 1 to the support of A of AI. Of course, these AIs constitute a decreasing sequence of projectors. So in particular, they commute. And using that fact, it's pretty easy to show that this indeed is a Hermitian operator with whole number eigenvalues. Also, the correspondence in the other way is pretty straightforward to show as well. To give an example, we'll just go consider a projection lattice with a Hilbert space of 3 dimensions. So I'll have an orthonormal basis here of 3 vectors. And just for a real simple quantum natural number A with support 3, we'll define these, which should give us a quantum natural number. So the first projector is the identity. The second is this 2-dimensional projector. The third is this 3-dimensional projector, easily seen to be decreasing. And so this quantum natural number corresponds to the observable that has these psi i's as eigenvectors, which with a hat psi n just equal to n psi n. And so given this correspondence between quantum natural numbers and observables with whole number eigenvalues, I'll usually just identify them from now on and not spend so much time treating them as two separate things. So now we have a notion of a quantum natural number and a successor. To get an arithmetic, we also need an addition and multiplication. And so we assume that maybe since this connection between the quantum natural numbers and Hermitian operators pops out so naturally, that the sum and product that we use for our addition should actually reproduce the usual linear algebraic sum and product when the quantum natural numbers correspond to commuting observables. Writing out this addition and multiplication, we find that it's described by these formulas. So recall this notation up here where these ans are the decreasing sequence of projectors corresponding to our quantum natural number. Then the nth projector for a plus b is described by this disjunction in the projection lattice. And this multiplication is described here. Now, when you write these out for commuting observables, you immediately notice that they also correspond to decreasing sequences of projectors, regardless of whether A and B are commute. And so noticing that this addition and multiplication naturally give an additional multiplication on the set of quantum natural numbers, we'll use this as our interpretation for our plus and our times. Of course, they better satisfy the arithmetic axioms. I do want to point out, from this point on, I'm going to stick to the finite dimensional case. There's just some subtleties in infinite dimensions that I don't want to take the time to go into. But so in the finite dimensional case, these quantum natural numbers with the addition and multiplication so defined do, in fact, satisfy some axioms for arithmetic. Of course, these are not the usual piano axioms. By Dunn's result, they couldn't be. There's only classical models of the piano axioms. But these axioms are strictly stronger than an axiomatization called Robinson arithmetic, if you're familiar with that. And we could actually write more properties down that this arithmetic satisfies. In particular, if you consider any two-variable identity of classical arithmetic, so if p is some polynomial and q is some polynomial in addition, multiplication, successor, such as this, then we have the following result. So if p acting on n and m is equal to q acting on n and m for all natural numbers n and m, then we'll also have that this polynomial is equal to this polynomial for all quantum natural numbers as well. So all two-variable identities, in fact, hold in this quantum arithmetic. And this will be true even when a and b do not correspond to commuting observables. I mean, of course, compared to the linear algebraic sum, this is wildly different. The simplest polynomial you can think of, n times m equals m times n, I mean, that clearly doesn't hold for the linear algebraic product. So this is a significantly different sort of operation than the usual linear algebraic sum and product. Of course, not all of the usual identities of arithmetic will hold. In particular, we begin to see some failures once we go to identities involving three or more variables. So as an example, we have that associativity of addition and multiplication generically fail, as does distributivity of addition over multiplication. Of course, when A, B, and C all commute, B's hold like normal. They just reduce to the usual linear algebraic sum of product. But generically, they do fail. Now, given that we have this sum and product, we can interpret them as new operations on observables. And so as operations on observables, they have some interesting properties. First of all, they respect eigenvectors, by which I mean that if they have a common eigenvector, psi, so that, you know, a psi equals little a times psi, and b psi equals little b times psi, then we find that it's still an eigenvector of both a plus b and a times b, with exactly the eigenvalues you'd expect. So little a plus little b and little a times little b for the sum and product respective. And so maybe that's not too surprising. This is actually something you find for the linear algebraic sum and product, even when a and b don't commute. But this next property is significantly different. So basically, I'll just state this for the sum. If you have any eigenvalue of a plus b, then it is of the form little a plus little b, where these are eigenvalues of a and b respectively. I mean, this is just drastically different than what you'd see for the linear algebraic sum of non-commuting guys. And a similar result holds for the product.
These are bounded operators.
Oh, what's that?
These are bounded operators also.
Yeah, everything's, this is all in finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Yeah, so everything's bounded. Although you can, yeah, you can actually generalize this property to infinite dimensions, and you will actually still retain this thing for bounded operators.
But in case of, in this case, there are problems with essential sets of objects of common domain, unbounded operators. Like,
yeah, I'm not sure if this works for unbounded operators, but it does work for bounded ones.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we have this new sum and product on observables. A natural question to ask is there a natural interpretation in terms of measurement of these observables? So it turns out there is a somewhat natural interpretation, at least. So we call these quantum natural numbers. They correspond to decreasing sequences of projectors. And since these projectors all commute, we can think of a measurement of the quantum natural number A as a simultaneous measurement of all these decreasing projectors. And so you can sort of think of these as like a sequence of filters. A1 is the correspondence to the biggest subspace of the Hilbert space. So it filters out the least, and then you filter out progressively more and more states as you go down. And so we see that the sum and product do respect sort of this filter interpretation, by which I mean that if you have any state in your Hilbert space such that it passes the jth filter of A and it passes the kth filter of B, then it'll also pass this j plus kth filter of A plus B, and similarly it'll pass the j times kth filter of A times B. Moreover, these are actually the unique operations with which both respect eigenvectors, as I mentioned on the previous slide, and also satisfy this filter property, along with one small technical requirement that I don't really want to go into. It's sort of a uniformity requirement. But for this reason, it's not the nicest result we could have. Definitely want an interpretation entirely stated in terms of measurement. But still, it's a pretty weak assumption, this extra requirement. And so there is, or at least seems to be, a fairly natural interpretation of these numbers in terms of measure. Just to review what we've gone over so far. We developed a new quantum set theory using this quantum logic, and generalizes the usual classical set theoretic universe in a natural way, yielding a very tractable theory. It's easy to work with. Also, this theory is powerful enough to construct at least a branch of mathematics, namely arithmetic and the quantum natural numbers. Moreover, these are tied to quantum observables in a natural way. So this arithmetic, furthermore, if you interpret it as operations on observables, has some nice properties. First of all, it not only respects eigenvectors, but also respects eigenvalues in the sense I mentioned before. And moreover, it has a fairly natural interpretation in terms of measurement, although we would like to sharpen this and give a better characterization. And yet, this work is really just the tip of the iceberg as far as quantum mathematics goes. I mean, of course, essentially every branch of mathematics that's ever been done in classical logic can be re-examined under the light of quantum logic to see what it might yield. But that's more of a pure mathematics question. I'm more interested in the following question, which is, can we actually use this quantum set theory to develop a quantum mathematics that will be suitable for a reformulation of quantum mechanics? And so let me just finish off by being a little speculative of how this might go. Just as we develop the quantum natural numbers, and these corresponded naturally to quantum mechanical observables with whole number eigenvalues, the idea is to push further, next develop the integers. This we've actually already done. This works fine. And then from there to move on to the rationals, from the rationals to the reals. And ideally, the reals would then correspond exactly to all observables, just as the natural numbers corresponded to those with natural number eigenvalues. Then once we have this, we could potentially develop a quantum calculus. Once we have a calculus using quantum mathematics, we can begin to start to state and investigate classical mechanics and classical field theory using quantum mathematics. And so the wildest hope would be that basically starting with just the equations of classical physics, developing them along the lines of quantum mathematics, what we would find is exactly the quantum theory. And so this would, you know, give not only a new method of quantization, but also it would provide a radically new framework to interpret the relation between classical physical theory and quantum theory. And so that's about all I wanted to say. So thanks for your time.
Questions?
Yeah.
So this last idea is very interesting. In quantum theory as it stands, or even in classical theory, you have also evolution. So in quantum theory, for example, you have sort of general evolution, not just operators corresponding to sort of measurement or projection value measurement. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, but also you have unitary evolution and other types of evolution.
Yeah.
Do you see a way to include that?
I mean, how I think that this would go is that what you'd get is sort of a Heisenberg picture of evolution of observables.
Okay.
Out of this, but.
So where would T? What would T? So then it would be a time parameter in there.
Right. Exactly. You'd have to start to consider. You know, you basically start with some differential equations, which you would state sort of axiomatically within this quantum mathematics, and then you would deduce the consequences of those equations. So you would begin to prove theorems within quantum mathematics that says, given this initial state, this is how the future state would go, or given these initial, what the observables are, you'd get these equations for operator evolution.
Yes,
yeah, can you come back to, I think it was slide 23, maybe, when you talk about Q, P of AB equal to Q of AB? Yeah.
This one?
Just there? Yeah, there. So, this P and Q are any function? What are they? How do you define P of AB if AB doesn't commute? Don't you have factor ordering in ambiguity?
No, so these are just actually any expression in the formal syntax of arithmetic, using only addition, multiplication, successor, zero. So this number three really is shorthand for the successor applied three times to the number zero. And then you also have variables and so on. So basically, it's just any expression involving only two distinct variables in the formal syntax of arithmetic.
Okay.
But what about products of those different ones? How do you order them? How do you decide how to order them?
As far as the actual expression of this polynomial, it's whatever order they're written in. So the formal string of symbols that'll occur in a particular order. Yeah, and so then the interesting result is that by this theorem, it doesn't actually matter which order, you'll get the same result.
But wouldn't it also imply that AB for operators is always equal to BA?
Yeah, exactly. So this is not the linear algebraic product, it's a new product on operators.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I mean, of course, for commuting ones, it reduces to the usual.
So what are the deduction rules? Because somehow I was waiting for them to appear and I never saw them.
Yeah, so I just gave an entirely semantical approach to quantum logic. We could have done things in terms of formal deduction. And so you, just as the Boolean algebra, algebraic identities are very similar to the orthomodular lattice identities, what you obtain is a system of logical axioms in quantum logic, which are very similar to the classical axioms, although with some small changes. But the rules of inference, well, I mean, there's multiple ways of doing it, just like in classical logic. And so I could have written down the rules of inference if I wanted to do a formal deduction way of analyzing quantum mathematics, but I just chose the semantical approach.
But is it like model spawners or what?
Yeah, so the one that we use to prove soundness and completeness, it has modus ponens and actually a number of other rules of inference. It was sort of motivated by the formal deduction system used in Dunn's paper, although we changed it kind of significantly. But there's actually 5 rules of inference. So
is it arbitrary? Can you, or this one question, other questions, can you introduce various rules of deductions that lead to equivalent systems? And third question, is it the case, then what governance the choice?
Yeah, so I mean, generically, if you write down different deduction systems, they'll lead to different logics. I mean,
having this language and connectives and so on. Yes. And I'm just asking, like, can you form various reasonable systems of logical deduction, which you call one deduction calculus?
Yeah, I mean, what we took as the guiding light was basically this semantical approach where, and then we chose our deduction system so that it gave a theorem of soundness and completeness, so that every deduction you can make within that formal deduction system mirrors exactly a deduction you can make using the semantical system. So, I mean, basically this is, I think this was first proved by Dishkant using a different deduction system. And so there's a number of deductive systems you can use that are equivalent. You could probably use different ones as well, which would be inequivalent, but then it's not clear exactly how those would be quantum logical. It would just be some deduction system. You know, so the motivation for this choice of way of doing quantum mathematics was basically based on orthomodular lattices. Of course, you could use something different than orthomodular lattices, some different class of lattices, for example,
yeah.
And you'd need a different.
Yes, deduction system. Motivated to about the wondering about sort of. Of the choice of the semantics, and somehow it's more clear for me to think of it in terms of choosing a particular deductive system. Because naturally you can choose various semantics, but then like there is this script type semantics from Dishkant, there are those various later type semantics for, but it's like, I'm just wondering to what extent one can speak of sort of uniqueness or right choice of the particular way the full logic is and full system is constructed. And I have in mind that there are various implication connectives that could be introduced. And this is somehow it shows in a small scale that there is sort of ununiqueness when one tries to construct fully fledged quantum type, deductions or semantic-based deduction. So I'm just wondering to what extent this particular choice is arbitrary versus. Like how one, for example, how one would justify that this particular choice is the right one, whatever it means.
It's a good question. I mean, yeah, there's potentially different ways of doing this, for sure. The argument, basically, for choosing this to be the right one is that you get the soundness and completeness theorem with respect to the semantics. Like I said, we don't know if orthomodular lattices are really the right class of things to use for a semantics, and so if you had a better motivated semantics, then there would be a good argument for using a different deduction system. Pretty much everything that I've seen, at least, would fall within this class, so it would just be a restricted semantic, so it would fall within the class of orthomodular lattices. So in a sense, this is the most general that I know of that works. And so it's sort of if you just want to work as generally as possible, I mean, even if you're not doing the right one, this would still capture everything you wanted to do. It just might have too much. So that might be another argument for using this. But you might have something else in mind that I'm not aware of.
This is like, I think I was playing this business one day.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
So does this
go ahead.
So does the system include kind of arithmetic? Like, my question is, does this still fall under Griddle's completeness theorem? In that, like, does it contain pan arithmetic as a subset of the framework? And so, I don't know.
Piano arithmetic by the theorem of Dunn is inherently classical. So, if you write down the piano arithmetic axioms and try and do orthomodular or quantum logic with them, you just end up with classical mathematics. So in that sense, yes, I mean, it just is classical arithmetic. So of course it falls under the heading of Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Robinson arithmetic was actually basically developed to be the weakest arithmetic under which you could still prove Gödel's incompleteness theorem. And so, as I said, you know, these quantum axioms, these are stronger than Robinson arithmetic. However, the proof, of course, of Gödel's incompleteness theorem, you know, was done in classical logic. So we're really not sure if Gödel's incompleteness theorem still holds within this. So that's actually a really interesting question to try and investigate.
Any more questions? To us.
Yeah, you mentioned this idea of a quantum calculus. So I think there exists something like that already in non-commutative geometry. And I was wondering how much you would expect it to be the same or different. Or non-commutative geometry in the sense of spectral triples, this framework, which is something like quantum manifolds, quantum Riemannian manifolds.
Yeah, I'm not really all that familiar with it, so I'm not really qualified to say whether I think that this.
So also functions
that
are replaced by operators in a Hilbert space, and so it seems very much go in the same direction.
It's something I should look into, I guess, to see if I think that it might provide some motivation for some future work along these lines. But yeah, I just don't know.
Any other questions? Okay. Speaking.